Welcome here to St. Matthew in the city. Welcome to those who have been here before and for whom this is the first time. Welcome to this magnificent place. And welcome to you, Cynthia. Welcome to this place and to this land, to Aotearoa, New Zealand. You're most welcome in our midst. And may your playful and inquisitive child within be nurtured by the Wairua of this land and peoples.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Bev Sylvester Clark, and it's my great joy to be introducing Cynthia to you this evening. I'm sure that for a number of you anyway, Cynthia needs no introduction because her books and her recorded talks got to New Zealand well before her physical arrival. And those books and talks have been a rich source of soul meeting for those of you who have been fortunate enough to be exploring in them. For those of us in our spiritual searching and questing. But for those of you for whom this is a first meeting with Cynthia, I guess convention would have me introduce her as an Episcopalian priest who is the author of 5 excellent books. But I would prefer to introduce her as a woman of deep solitude. And the great paradox of this solitude is that out of it, a tremendous amount of wisdom has arisen, and the form in which it has been communicated to us, of course, are through these books and these wonderful talks. Not only is she a woman of deep solitude, but there's the other side of Cynthia, and that's a much more extroverted side, because she's an extremely busy woman out in the world as well. For example, she's the principal teacher of the Contemplative Society in Victoria, British Columbia, the founding director of the Aspen Wisdom School in Colorado, a faculty member of the Spiritual Paths Graduate Institute based in Colorado, California, and a well-known retreat leader and conference speaker, a busy woman. And we're so privileged to have you here, Cynthia. So thank you so much for your commitment to the inner journey, and thank you for your willingness to take this journey down here to New Zealand to be with us tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Viv. It's an honor and a blessing and the fulfillment of a life's dream to be here. I'm still pinching myself. I can't believe my good fortune. This has been one of the places I've wanted to be for 40 years or so. And when I received an invitation a few, 2 years ago, was it now? Four, from Pip and the group here to say, come on down and give some talks and lead some retreats. It's very, very exciting and very wonderful. I've received in the 36 hours or so that I've been here a marvelous welcome. So I think that how to begin with this little bit of time we have coming up, I hope that some of you are coming from our retreat next weekend here, back here in Auckland. I think that I'd like to actually preface what I'm going to be talking about tonight with a couple of things. The first thing is I know that we're in a largish kind of group, and churches with pews facing forwards and rattly vibrations are not the greatest of places to encourage dialogue. But I'm also well aware of the wonderful uniqueness and opportunity of this occasion, that so many of you have come from either close places or far places to be members of a group here because something in your heart has brought you out. And if there's a way to tap the energy, the insight, the wisdom, and the collective energy of all of you who are there in questions, in dialogue, that would be wonderful. I'm much more interested in finding out what you think and what you want to know than in repeating what I think and what I want to know. So we'll see if we can make that happen. The other thing I'd like to do, just to preface my comments, is to say that I feel really privileged, not just because I've wanted to see New Zealand forever, but because this past year in my life, I have found myself jet-setted as it were, into a world that before I would never have really known existed. It started about a year and a half ago when my daughter moved to London with my three grandchildren and my son-in-law. And so dutifully last February, February 2008, I made my first voyage to London in about 40-some years. And I was met at the airport by my daughter's driver, this wonderful big fellow from Ghana. And we weren't out of the airport parking lot when he said, "Obama, is he going to win?" And a month later, I found myself at Jaipur at a wonderful event called the Global Peace Initiative of Women Conference, where for 8 days, we had spiritual leaders, both men and women, from all over the world, holding a vision and a statement of a new collectivity of humanity. And then not a week after that, we were in Dharamsala, and we were going to have an audience with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But the day before we arrived, as you may remember from back in the news, a group of young marchers set out on a peaceable march to go back toward Tibet. They didn't get very far, but we, with thousands of others, marched in a circle around this beautiful meditative path around the Dalai Lama's palace, the Kora, in prayers for world peace and world beginning. And my sense is that we are at a very unique and powerful time in the life of our planet and in the life of human consciousness, in a way that we haven't seen before. We're one world. You know, that the American people didn't elect Barack Obama, the world did. And it elected him with the hopes that we can begin for the first time to begin to articulate what is the conduct and the spiritual value and the human value that human beings need to bear to be citizens of this beautiful planet and to do the jobs that we need to do and to find our spirituality not in opposition to each other as we've done for so many millennia, but as one human being, one human family, expressing values that are deep in our hearts and deep in our cultures. And I'm very aware that having been in this beautiful country for only, 36 hours now, that New Zealand and the particular kind of energy and spirituality and rootedness of this place is an important element in the recovering of this beautiful, what does it mean to be a human being and a member of the human family in the 21st century? And so it's really in that spirit that I come before you, and I hope that this conversation is not merely a lecture, which is interesting, and then you go back and do other things, but that it can become a way of nurturing a new planetary spirit. Many people are saying out there, and a year ago I wouldn't have believed it, but now I do, that we are on the rise of a new kind of collective human consciousness. That back about 2,500 years ago, there was a period in the history of the world where right around the world, like the sun moving across the universes, gave birth to something called the axial period. And it's where individuated human consciousness first arose, the idea that I could be in a personal relationship with God, that my salvation mattered, that I belonged to a family and a culture. And most of our great religions were born in that era. Now we're coming to a new period that some are calling the second axial. And it has a different configuration to it. And when you look, and if you Google that on the various websites, I swear that in the list of the characteristics of this new period, you will find in the top 10 relatedness. as one of the descriptions. There is a new understanding that consciousness is collective. And by collective, we don't mean tribal in the old way, my tribe good, your tribe bad, but that there is a kind of energy, wisdom, responsibility, and a kind of energy of compassion that binds our hearts in ways that no one is separate in this planet. And that we're developing new ways to be together, to think together, to understand situations together that go far beyond the polarized and inherently discriminatory thought perceptions that have characterized the human race for 2,000 years, into a brand new way of seeing, perceiving, being, and cherishing each other. And it's against that backdrop that I find myself here in this corner of the universe, tremendously aware of the opportunity and the honor of being present among you, and hoping that in the little time we have together that we can do service to this collective awakening. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Christianity, and within this context, that great, wonderful British essayist of a century and a half or so ago, G.K. Chesterton, once quipped. He said, "Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." Or in other words, to put it in the common parlance, Christianity isn't a failure. It just hasn't been tried yet. And I think these are very, very wise words, and they convey in a nutshell the 20 or 30 year quest that finally led to the writing of my book, The Wisdom of Jesus. Almost as a young adult, caught very deeply by the power and the beauty and the presence of Christianity and the great mystery that you can catch just in the simple beauty and holiness of this space, I became increasingly aware of and more bothered by this profound discrepancy between means and ends in Christianity, that we have a religion that whose teaching and whose founder and whose founding is so grounded in a completely self-giving and affirming and empowering love. And yet, the forms in which Christianity has been expressed over the centuries and in which it continues to express itself today are so much the language of judgment and exclusion and territorial proprietorships. Why is a religion that's founded in love so easily and so unconsciously, as it is, bring forth forms of being that tend to be judgmental, rigid, exclusive, and fear-bound? And that became the question. I mean, it bothered me as a kid, and it bothered me even as I continued to go on and go to seminary and become collared, and it still bothers me. And it essentially sent me on a 20-year search. What went wrong? Why is a religion that is completely founded and grounded in love expressing itself so often in, well, which body do we have to exclude in order that we can have purity and rigidity? And, you know, Christianity includes everybody, but not you. There's something the matter with you. Oh, not you. So that became my search. The more I went on with my life as an Episcopal priest, the more pressing that question became. And it led me basically on a 20-year search that took me through some very interesting corners. Christian mysticism, some of the neighboring religions, Sufism, the Gurdjieff work, trying to find an answer of how could a religion, which starts so clearly from such a high plane of consciousness, express itself in forms that are so unconscious and so hurtful. And what I finally came to realize more and more was that almost from the start, people had not gotten what Jesus was up to. I began to see more and more clearly that what we have in Jesus, and for the moment, setting aside any kind of things that you may know doctrinally, we'll get back to that in a minute, about the only Son of God and second person of the Trinity, any setting that aside without saying whether that's true or not true, the one thing that we can that clearly began to become resonant for me was that Jesus was a spiritual master of an extraordinarily high order. And I think that a way to put that is to say that he was the first teacher of non-dualism that the Near Eastern, the Christian West had ever seen. He's the first person who came from what we would now call, from a Buddhist perspective or a Eastern perspective, a genuine non-dualist, an enlightened master who didn't see in terms of either or, them or us, but saw from a whole new place. And since he saw from a place that was so far beyond what most of the people who he was teaching saw, of course the message got lost in translation. We have a teacher with a great holistic, non-dual, comprehensive vision, and people didn't get it from the start because they couldn't think at that level. And so what we've had is a Christianity that the cognitive dissonance that I experienced as a child was quite right, that it was the tension between the real inherent place that Jesus was seeing from and the every single interpretation of it that had ever been written or read. And there's some reasons for that. And began to test out a little that one of the greatest operational difficulties we have as Christians, one of the things that most stands in the way nowadays of our being able to enter and access this wonderful body of teachings, is the fact that we do our Christianity with 20/20 hindsight. From about the 4th century on, Christianity became a religion about Jesus, not of Jesus. And the idea, that's a phrase from that wonderful modern teacher, Elaine Peierls, who wrote the book Beyond Belief, a wonderful scholar from Princeton University who's done a lot to help uncover this lost and missing history. But the sense is that as part of our honest sense of how we pass on the story, we tell the story, and we our basic way of telling who Jesus is and of affirming our identity as Christians is through the creeds. And so from the very beginning, we're taught we believe in one God, the Father Almighty, you know, and we begin to learn facts about Jesus, and then we argue with one another about whether we have our facts correct. But one day, this idea of doing our Christianity from 20/20 hindsight leaves us with two very serious mistakes. The first mistake is the assumption that if this were happening in our own time, we would recognize him and we'd be on the winning team. And the other more serious problem is this idea of trying to recognize by affirming what we know in facts and data blinds and puts us out of touch with the very thing we need. We most need to follow the path and the teaching that he's actually doing. So one day I tried a little experiment with a group of parishioners. I sat them down in a coffee hour after a sermon and said to them, well, you know, if Jesus hadn't risen from the dead, would that make a difference to your following them? Well, I got exactly what I expected. It was a trick question. Of course it would. I got looks of panic and an immediate dialogues based on the Nicene Creed. Well, of course it was, because he's the second son of God, because we're a resurrection faith, because this is the only and most singular thing that happened on the planet, and it proves that in God was in Christ Jesus reconciling the world to himself. On and on it went. And this is all good and true, and I'm not disregarding any of it. But the point is, the folks gathered on that hot summer day along the shores of the Sea of Galilee didn't know any of that. For them, they didn't know how it was going to come out. They didn't know there was going to be a crucifixion. They didn't know there was going to be a resurrection. They didn't know anything like that. They couldn't possibly decide whether they were going to follow this man based on the fact that he rose from the dead and they hoped to do likewise. It had to be something much more intimate, much more immediate, not a memorized dogma, but something much more by the seat of their pants or the seat of their heart that grabbed them in that moment and said, do you trust me or not? Are you going on that path or not? Who or what in you recognizes? Well, I had a very interesting experiment with that whole incredible white knuckle, seat of the pants sort of stuff. About 10 years ago in Canada, I was teaching in Canada, and the word went out, there's this wonderful, powerful new guru who's working in Edmonton, who's just doing amazing things. He's out there. He's out Buddha's the Buddha. And there was all sorts of conflicted things. But he's beautiful. He's a spiritual master. He's great. Yeah, but he's also got three wives, two at once. And, you know, the clergy in town don't like him. And people say, don't go near him because he's dangerous. So I went up to check it out, along with people saying, can anything good be born in Edmonton? And I have to tell you, I was in the presence of one of the most powerful teachers I'd ever seen. And the contrary signals were going like this. When I walked into the room, he came in with this beautiful saintly aura about that far out of him, sat down on a dais. Immediately 10 women went, oh, and fainted, you know, and there was this all gazing, and I got frightened. This is. And then somebody came up and asked him a question, and he took it with absolute clarity, pierced through about 2,000 years of cultural baggage, and just dealt with her issue brilliantly. And I felt my heart going, boop, 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 boop. Do you trust or do you not trust? And that, I think, is the epicenter of what we have to get back today. Who or what in you knows that you're going to place your hand in the hand of somebody who's going to take you through you where you do not want to go to the place where you most desperately do want to go? How do you know? What in you is ready to say yes or no? It doesn't have anything to do with doctrines, dogmas, after-the-fact learning. It has to do with a kind of energy, a kind of authenticity, a kind of integrity you sense in the moment through a living encounter that takes place in your heart. And that is how religious, you know, spiritual work has been done for as long as there's been spiritual work. And all these castles of dogma and doctrine basically are obscuring and taking away, for very good reasons, because we like to have the picture and the reverence, but they're taking away from us the development of something that we were given when we came onto the planet, which is absolutely essential to our development and maturation into full human beings in love and in consciousness and integrity that we're called to be. That we need to learn to nurture the heart. The heart understood not as this organ of emotion, but as a faculty of spiritual authenticity and perception inside us that allows us in a moment, out of the integrity of what we are, to register what is true, what is trustworthy, and what we're going to unfold. So it's this quality that needs to be recaptured in each one of us and in our world and in our Christianity for it once again to emerge as a vital living source of this creative love that was only about 2,000 years ahead of its time. I would say that in my own journey, sometimes I laugh and say that everything I learned about Jesus, I learned in meditation. And I would actually say I learned it through centering prayer. It wasn't that I didn't learn facts. I did. I went to seminary. I learned all the, you know, I can do the documents. And incidentally, I would say I don't have any quibbles with most of this. It's not that the facts are wrong, it's just that there's something deeper. But in meditation, I sat for a long time, and that the practices that I began to learn were key practices, and I didn't know this at the time, to awakening the heart, this atrophied organ of spiritual perception. And I've said many, many times that I think that if we're going to recover a Christianity which can live with a living, moving, and still risen and present master, we have to begin by recovering the methodology, the practices that will help us to tune in a different level and in a different way. And for most of us, that comes through a meditation practice. And that I know that many of you here probably have your own meditation practices. I know some of you here are practicing. In the last 20, 30 years, we've seen a marvelous possibility of the recovery of meditation in Christianity, principally through centering prayer and Christian meditation, which sit people down and actually get them working at a very important discipline for awakening the heart. Now, when I started centering prayer, I guess 25 years ago, I had no idea where this journey was going. I knew that I wanted some escape from just the squirrel cage trap of my mind. I knew that meditation was being recovered in the tradition. I was invited to go to do a centering prayer weekend in Snowmass, Colorado. And meditation seemed to be a wonderful way to re-access Christian contemplative practice, the practice of silence. And it took me about 20 years of working through it before I could gradually see that this particular kind of meditation was altering how I thought. Not what I thought, but how I thought. We're just now beginning to get wonderful data. The Dalai Lama is putting a lot of his effort into scientific research to corroborate this, that meditation really rewires the brain in very powerful ways. And what I was noticing in my own way was that, first of all, it gives us a far greater capacity for tolerating ambiguity and ambivalence. As a matter of fact, you absolutely love paradox, which is not something that our linear analytic mind can do. That it has to have it. It has to be, if it's X, it can't be Y. If it's A, it can't be B. If you're Islamic, you can't be Christian. If you're Catholic, you can't be Protestant. You know, we think in terms with our linear mind of mutually exclusive categories. In meditation, you begin to learn to tunnel down so that you can hold paradox and understand that precisely in paradox, a different quality of human expansiveness and richness is made possible. And so that's what it does. The first thing it does is it increases your tolerance for ambiguity. It allows you to live with the fact that, yeah, you can have churches where there are people that are gay, and you can have churches that aren't, and you can have women priests, and you can not, and you can have different. So what? Get a life. We're human beings. Let's live as a family. But it takes a mind that's comfortable in paradox to live with the true pluralism of the human family. And the second thing that meditation brings is the capacity for what I would call integral perception, which means you don't just see the part, you see the whole, and you see how the part fits from how it fits within the whole. So that rather than seeing little bits and pieces of separate, disconnected, and competitive things, you see a picture in which you find your place by how the whole sounds. The great mystic Jacob Burma talked in the 17th century. He had a wonderful image. He said, "I am a string in the concert of God's joy," in which all the various instruments play their parts to make manifest a kind of symphony of meaning that requires particularity and requires harmony. That other mind fostered by meditation grasps that. And the third thing it does that has tremendous importance to Christianity is that it grasps intuitively. It's an intuitive mind. It understands. It is capable in that mind, that deeper mind, to meet a Jesus who's not dead and gone away, but a living, resonant, intimate, energetic presence pervading this whole cosmos with a coherence and a compassion that can't be dreamed of. It's possible to meet instantly and inwardly in the heart, in this vision, a sense of how all fits together and a sense of being held and met in an ongoing mystery that we're all dancing within. So all of these parts that don't show up and are completely invisible to a rational mind are met by a meditation which helps us to do the most important thing, which is to, in the words of the Eastern Orthodox tradition, to put the mind in the heart. And this is what's been missing for Christianity for so long. We put the mind in the mind. But the need to put the mind in the heart and to get down to that place that was that same place that those people along the shores of Galilee went to when they looked at this person out here and said, yes or no. That same sort of yes or no is out there in every moment of our life in this birthing of our new century. And I'm not talking about do you accept this man as your Lord? I'm talking about that every moment is fresh with the possibility of, do we accept the mystery of the unknown? Do we see how it connects? Do we birth and midwife anew that we don't see yet with our eyes, but we feel with our hearts? Or do we say, no, that's too scared, that's too weird, we move off from that? Our hope is that in opening the heart through our meditation, through our practice, we can see and explore an invitation to wholeness, which is ever fresh, ever freshly offered. So it was actually in meditation, I would just want to say, that I found and put together the piece that was the kind of missing piece for me of how the centering prayer that I had been working on for maybe 20 years or so connected with this mystery I'd been holding in my other hand of Jesus. Where's this discrepancy? Why is this teacher of love rigidified in a religion of power and control? Where's the missing link? So in centering prayer, I don't know how many of you in the room practice it. I hope many of you will begin to practice it, because I think it's really foundational to this path that's unfolding. But centering prayer is a simple form of meditation, in which what you do is simply you're holding a state of open availability to divine presence at a very deep level, deeper than your thinking, deeper than your emotions, deeper than your memories, deeper than your visions. It's like I make myself deeply available to the presence of divine reality here and there. And the way we work at this, in this very simple form of meditation, is just that when a thought comes up, so that you start thinking it, you let it go. The deal in centering prayer is you catch yourself thinking, you let the thought go. So I'm sitting here in meditation, you know, I'm having a nice, I wonder how long it's going to take us to get home tonight. I wonder what way we'll go. Will the stars be up? Thinking, let it go. So we keep practicing. Centering prayer is a prayer where we just work over and over and over it, letting go of the thoughts. And I would find myself, when I was trying to teach centering prayer, trying to explain to people what it is about this motion that's so important. I mean, it doesn't feel like prayer. We're not saying, "Dear God, bring me down beauties," or "Take care of Aunt Thelma," or, and if you have a mystical vision in centering prayer, it's just a thought and you have to let it go. So I was trying to figure out what is the value of this, of a meditation that's, you don't even have clear mind or crystal presence or an inner observer. It's just you're letting go of thoughts. No. And then all of a sudden one day, in this whole way that the spiritual life occurs to me, I realized that this letting go motion that we were practicing in the centering prayer was what St. Paul was talking about in his famous writing, his famous hymn in Philippians 2:9, when he talks about putting on the mind of Christ, and he says, "You also should have in you that same mind which is in Christ." And he said, though his state was that of God, his being, of course, Jesus's, yet he did not deem equality with God something he should cling to. What do you think is the most important word in that sentence? Cling. And each of you make a motion on the count of three. Put down your things. And on the count of three, make a motion that would look to you like clinging. And then hold that position, okay? One, two, three. Now look around the room. Doesn't look like a very friendly place, does it? Actually, it looks like church on Sunday morning. So it says, he did not deem equality with God something he should cling to. Rather, he emptied himself. The word used in the Greek for that is kenosein. It means to let go. And it's the opposite of clinging. So rather, he emptied himself. And assuming the state of a slave, was born in human form. He, being one of us, humbled himself further yet, even to death on the cross. But so we have in Paul, in that moment of brilliance, he got it, that Jesus didn't cling, he let go. And all of a sudden, a little light went off that says, ha, that's what we're doing in centering prayer. We're practicing thought by thought by thought this very counterintuitive methodology of letting go. Don't hang on. Don't cling. Don't identify. Don't protect. Don't brace. Let go. So a thought comes up, we let it go. Thought comes up, we let it go. And I began to see that centering prayer really, as a meditation method working within Christian milieu, is a form of practicing this basic kenotic gesture. It's a path of non-clinging, like the Buddhists have, although with a slightly different color to it. And we practice thought by thought by thought. We let go, we let go, we let go. Well, what good was that For a while, I could see that what that was doing is it gave me a way of linking what I was doing in my centering prayer practice with a piece of Christianity which was authentically, theologically, 100% accurate. So that if anybody says, well, meditation doesn't really belong in Christianity, I say, yes, it does, because we're practicing this kenotic motion, which is at the heart of the Jesus path. And what Jesus did, if you really look at it, and you go back and read the parables and all his teachings from this point of view, you'll find that this is what he's doing everywhere. He says to the rich man with his, you know, wants to enter the kingdom, you know, just let go of your money. But he couldn't. Have to hang on. And to the man who was building the barns, and in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, and that fool, that very night, his life was taken from him. Don't cling. Don't hoard. Don't hang on to your identity. Don't hang on to your pride. Don't hang on to your titles. Don't hang on to what you think you know. Let it go, says Jesus. Let it go. Let it go. And this practice is so counterintuitive to human beings that what Jesus had stumbled on back in the second century, or the, you know, the first century, whatever it was way back then, is in point of fact something very fascinating that modern brain science has begun to corroborate from a very different point of view. What modern brain science has shown us is that the human brain, and this is going to be a quick and dirty version, is actually a sedimentary deposit that's four little brains in one, and that at the very innermost, most primitive level is something which is called the reptilian brain. Guess why? We share it with the reptiles, and it governs our basic, most primitive survivalist mentality. Given a stimulus out in the environment, it has three choices. Do I eat it, run from it, or mate with it? That's the reptilian brain. And when it's triggered, it gives you highly energized but rather repetitive, archaic, reflexive defense mechanisms. Around that, we have our emotional limbic brain, which seems to be the root stem of our basic affective sense of self and basic emotions. It connects with all sorts of other avenues of the brain in really rich ways. We then pass on to our human life and have our cortexes, left and right. And then around those, the prefrontal lobes, which actually emerge late. We aren't born with them fully developed. They come into our life in two major spurts when we're just tiny, 11, 12 months old, and then 15 or 16. But they seem to have the function of governing and making this whole unruly sedimentary deposit become one functioning unit. And they also connect in beautiful, powerful ways with the brain and the heart, which actually exists as a powerful resonant field. Anyway, what modern science and people like the Heart Math Institute and other people have been able to not only find but image and photograph is that how we react to a stimulus out in the world is sort of like one of those good old pinball games. You know, you can shoot your little ball and it'll go down various little slots. And how we react to a stimulus in the world determines what brain route it's going to take. If we react to a stimulus in the world by going, any form of what we were doing 5 minutes ago, clinging, bracing, rejecting, if our initial response is, guess where the stimuli goes? Right down into the reptilian brain, where we are given highly energized, but basically repetitive, ritual, stupid behaviors. And it doesn't matter whether you're a PhD or a bishop or a pope, you know, all your education and holiness will only fan the flames of that reptilian reaction. If you learn as your initial response, it takes your neural pathway is completely different, and it takes in these other more civilized and flexible cortices of your brain, connects with the brain and the heart. The heart and the mind get entrained better, And even without any theological statements, you're able to say that you just have a hell of a lot more intelligence available to you if you're not constricting your brain with defense and negativity. Somewhere along the way, Jesus learned that. It looks like he started out his life self-identifying as a Nazarite, a Jew under an extreme ascetic vow, working on all the external piety of our time, the observations of the dietary restrictions, the sexual restrictions, the holier-than-thou. Somewhere along the line, he learned, and he moved into the planet with this revolutionary philosophy. It's not what's outside that contaminates you. It's what's in the heart that makes you pure or makes you constricted. And he gave us this astonishing beatitude, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Now, we often interpret that nowadays to mean, well, blessed are the ones that are pure, that are, you know, sexually clean or not, you know. Pure in heart means single in heart, open in heart, unguarded in heart, so that the heart, seen as an organ of spiritual perception, can do just what we were talking about earlier, can look at a situation and say yes, without having to know the dogmas and the doctrines and the facts, can open and see the pattern of immense compassion and coherence holding our world together. A constricted heart and entrained brain can't do that. And so Jesus taught a path of radical kenosis. Let go, let go, let go. Let go not only of your possessions, but more of your intellectual possessions, your pride, your sense of identity, your sense you know who you are, anything that makes you go, let go. Not because he's preaching a kind of pitiless stoicism. Not because all the world is just transient passing phenomena and it's not all emptiness. But because what he saw is that when we get constricted by doing this, we can't see the fullness of the divine love that surrounds us. At Luke 12, he said in a beautiful place, "Do not be afraid, little flock. It is my Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." But it's like we're standing knee-deep in a river crying for water. That as long as we are like this, we become spiritually blind. So Jesus discovered somewhere along the way in this radical teaching that as we open, as we let go, as we practice this motion of kenosis, as we live this motion of kenosis, we see the goodness, the collectivity, the compassion at the root, the abundance at the root of this kingdom. That as long as we're in our usual mind, isolated, separated, defending, we're going to see separation, alienation, and enemies. It's not because they're real. But for Jesus, perception preceded lived reality. And that as we open our heart, we see what is the abundance that really holds us. We see that our universe is set up to run very powerfully on a giving is receiving dance of abundance that we're all called to be a part of. Well, of course, that seeing cannot be sustained on closed hearts. So what's beginning to happen in our own time, and I'm going to wrap this up fairly shortly so we can hear from you, what's beginning to happen in our own time, I believe, is that this great shift ahead of consciousness, both within Christianity and within our brother and sister religions, are helping us to come back to release once again what the secret was. And the practice of meditation that is now back in our tradition, is helping us practice the motion which supports within us a vision which you might call a beatitude vision, so that we don't just memorize them, but live them as a wager of trust, as a wager of collectivity. And it's a very interesting and desperate stakes in our own time, because we sense that in a way the planet is converging. You know, there are a lot of theories out there that say breakthrough or breakdown, that's Laszlo's words, but that we're converging to a point where we're actually going to have to see a new human collectivity. We're going to have to sense it in our bones. We're going to have to begin to act as a one that people haven't even been able to grasp that concept of oneness, once much less make themselves a part of it. And these capacities to do this and make this axial shift in consciousness are within us. And they were exactly what Jesus was talking about 2,000 years ago. And that as we come back to our tradition, if we can just sort of return once again to the heart and understand this extraordinary, simple, majestic, and mysterious link in the tradition between kenosis, the letting go, as an act of cleansing the heart, cleansing the lens of perception, opening our underbellies to the vulnerability of God, then we can begin to live in the world seeing a little bit of the glimmer of the map of the goodness, of the love, of the connectedness, of the abundantness of God for us, if you want to put it that way, flowing into this world to create out of this world something beautiful and precious, God's heart, making itself manifest. I think we have a way open to us in a way that hasn't been possible before to live this with renewed energy, conviction, and beauty. I've often said, as I go and teach around about the planet, I never know whether I'm a hospice worker or a midwife for organizational forms of Christianity. But I do know that I think that this is one of the most exciting eras to be born in, to be born Christian in. I think there's a capacity to reclaim and understand and rekindle and develop new forms of being together in this religion that, like Chesterton said, allow us to try it and to ride it in a way that it will take its place in the family of world religions with the beauty and dignity and vulnerability that it really is intended to have, becoming a path for our own that we can walk ourselves with confidence and that we can walk in the planet with the kind of confidence and beauty that it deserves. So, with that in mind, I open the floor to any kind of questions or comments.
How is the American Christian right going to let go its fears?
How is the American Christian right going to let go of its fears? And the radical Islamic right and all the other rights? You know, I think that the question is more a leaven than the lump kind of answer. That most of the great spiritual teachers of the world say that a little bit of consciousness in the right places can trump a lot of fear. And that Ken Wilber, and some of you probably have worked with his work, he's done these wonderful map makings of levels of human consciousness. And that most of our society globally is still at a sort of relatively what they call mythic membership level of consciousness, very concerned with group identity, with it's sort of like the stuff you saw in the Old Testament. This is my tribe. I'm defending myself against my tribe. Your tribe is wrong. That consciousness is still out in the world. But what the wager always is that that kind of consciousness can be absorbed and transformed by a certain kind of love. And it doesn't happen quite directly. It's not like we're all going to go out and, you know, hug a fundamentalist. But it's like amazing things happen that when each person does their part. And that I think that what we began to see, and I as an American, I have to come back and just share some of my amazement to be part of the last 12 months in American history, because it was statistically impossible for that election to happen. It just, you know, it couldn't have, you know, there weren't enough coalitions, there was nothing happening, but groups of people, small groups of people with a heart and a desire and a taste of a vision of something else found each other. And I've seen in 20 years or more of working with contemplatives that when the contemplative prayer movement began again in the, you know, when we rekindled it sort of back in the 70s and 80s, it was very much niched as a sort of personal wellness, therapeutic, holiness, spirituality thing. It had a private kind of cast to it. But all these years of people working together at this deep level of unitive prayer does affect, you know, the morphic fields of the planet. And so it sets up the possibility for some new actuality to fall into situations. So my sense in these things is that rather than trying to immediately structure a solution to a problem, do your part in the cosmos to hold a new field together with your friends. And then just watch as new events that were not possible before begin to fall in from some other place. Excellent question, and thank you for getting it started.
I think it was Lawrence Freeman who said that when people, fundamentalists, get together and meditate together, all of those differences just disappear. He was talking about something that Dalai Lama had done with a group of very angry people, just sat quietly and they meditated together and all of those differences just disappeared. I wanted to ask you whether you felt that with centering prayer that you needed to have some sort of mantra.
Well, there's different methodologies of doing meditation. And in the centering prayer format, it's really the simple methodology of letting go that carries the weight of the meditation. That in the Christian meditation practice, working with the mantra, it keeps a focus on a different part. It's learning to hold the attention still and at a point and in relationship with that point. They're both wonderful methodologies of meditation. And I think that when it comes to meditation, the important thing is that you find a practice that works and do it. I very, very much am somewhat perplexed and saddened by a tendency that of a sort of sectarianism among the movements. You know, we've got centering prayer and it's the best way to do it. We got Christian meditation. We've fought enough with words. Why should we fight with silence too? That, you know, that there are very distinct schools of going about meditation. And some are much more temperamentally suited to some people and some to others. I could never get anything going with classic mantric meditation, and it's my own mind. And it was only when I began to learn this letting go motion and centering prayer that clicked. But there are other people that just, that's too drifty, and they need something else. So my sense is, the journey really gets interesting when people working with different meditational practices meditate together. And I think this is really important and is something that I haven't seen enough of in the movements around the world where birds of a feather tend to flock together. But people doing classic mantric meditation, like in Christian meditation or other forms, just working with a word that's repeated. The Jesus Prayer is a wonderful form of mantric meditation. a lot of Sufi zikr is based on that, where you recite a word of God, a name of God over. It creates a clarity and sharpness of the mental space, which is phenomenal. What centering prayer brings, and I can sometimes, you know, I'm one of these synesthetes a little bit that sees in color, but when centering prayer is really rolling beautifully, it has a kind of golden, loving radiance. And when that and centering Christian meditation sit next to each other, there's a powerful field in the room, which is both very austere and very loving. We were very lucky in British Columbia, where I formed a group, to have people in equal numbers from those two groups working together. And immediately she said, wow, this is great. And for me, the importance, and I think Thomas Keating, my teacher, would say the same thing, that all meditation practices are intended to get you somewhere. And it's that somewhere that you ought to be paying attention to. That when you've ridden your donkey to the top of the mountain, you get off your donkey. And I would have to say that I think it's so important for people who are meditating to just not make an idol of their meditation practices or their meditation groups, but move on to allow yourself to be opened to the difference in insights, to the richnesses of our common contemplative traditions and all the great spiritual paths of the world, which are naming and bringing into being a different kind of reality, and to live together as brothers and sisters in the household of that oneness. So thank you.
Do you feel in centering prayer practice there's a difference between connecting with your heart, on your true deep heart, and connecting with God?
Connecting with your heart or connecting with God, is that what you said? Is there a difference?
Yeah.
No. There's what makes your question complex is that we are using whole different language structures when we talk about that. And most of the ways that we've talked about God in the West put God out there as someone else or something else. And so there's been this long-standing tension in Christianity. There's been this resistance to saying, I and the Father are one. I mean, when Jesus tried it, he himself nearly got stoned. And Christianity has been particularly phobic to any sort of thing that says that I am God or God is in me. And, you know, I think that it essentially boils down to language quibbles. When you ask the question, where do I stop and God begin, you realize how silly it is. That almost everything real in this planet operates in this intertidal zone. That Meister Eckhart said it beautifully. He said, there is that in the soul that dwells in God, and there is that in the soul by which God dwells in the soul. The language is tricky, but what he's trying to point to, back in an era when he could have been burned at the stake for it, was that you can't separate these two. And that what happens when you connect with your heart and when you are deeply in your heart is all the dualism of language that would make God out there disappears. So you can say that they're the same. Now, I think there still is important value in being able to keep that dualistic language. You know, it's not like the problem is that we've made God as something else out there and we got to get rid of that and we all have to have our gods within. It's not that simple, because that beautiful language of God out there apart from us allows us to enter all those motions that have to do with love, generosity, thou, beloved, intimacy. And so it's very, very profound experience, but it needs to be recaptured at a level which is more intimate, more connected to the heart, and more non-dual. Like an extraordinary, you know, in an extraordinary love relationship, when there are two and there are others, but they are so close together that they form a one that is greater than the sum of the parts. That's what we're really working toward, and we don't have language yet to convey it. But I think one of our wonderful tasks in the 21st century is we're going to very carefully and delicately begin to construct or retrieve some of the language that allows us to talk in Christianity of a genuine non-dualism, not one, not two, but both. So you can feel it at one moment is God in your heart, one moment is God out there, and realize they're both equally true.
Given your primary understanding is Jesus is a teacher of the heart or the way of the heart, why was he killed?
Why was he killed? There's nothing more threatening than an open heart.
So what is the political reality of then being a heart follower?
What is the political reality? That's a very interesting question. The political reality is very often that one is martyred, that there's any number of people that have had that happen to them. The other side of the reality, though, is that it doesn't stop there. And that's what the whole Paschal mystery and cultic side of the faith says. I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking as you raise that very important question, Glenn, I'm thinking about my dear friend and spiritual teacher, Brother Roger of Teze. He'd been my spiritual teacher for about 50 years. And when I visited him in 2000, I don't know, 30 years, he was 85 years old and already was back and forth between two worlds. And I don't mean senile. I mean, he was just, at one moment we met and he'd be with angels in, you know, a different realm, and then he's right present. And I said, why is this man still on the planet? I mean, already what was glowing through his skin was just pure light. 5 years later, he was 90 years old, virtually blind, and yet he would always be led into the evening prayer at the community in Teze. At one particular evening prayer, a disturbed pilgrim jumped over the fence and slit his throat in front of 2,500 young kids. And I knew in my heart what had happened when I was first told, but it was later confirmed to me, that one of the monks came running up to this poor woman and grabbed her and was, you know, almost as if he was going to pull her limb from limb right there. And Brother Roger, in his dying moments, just looked over and gave this look to the monk and smiled at the woman and gave her his blessing and was carried out and died 5 minutes later. And I remember he had told me back in 2000 when I would have asked him, why do you want to be on the planet? Why are you still here? He says, I want to share more deeply in the Paschal mystery of Christ. And I think that what we have to say is that the political ramifications are one aspect of it. But what we really are up to in this planet in a very, very deep way, the sacramental life, the life of the profound revelation of love, trumps our politics and brings them to their knees, both in shame and in a different kind of triumph. I have a theory that this world, you know, so many of the great religious traditions say there's something the matter with it, it's a fall, it's a mirage, it's bad karma, it's illusion, that this world, with all its boundariedness, and all its hard edges and all its cruelty and all its injustice, is here as the precise set of conditions so that something can be named and articulated here that cannot be named and articulated in any other condition. And I think that that has to do with a certain essence of love, which is made possible only under conditions of intense constriction, intense pressure, and sometimes even heartbreak. Things like fidelity are qualities of love that only make sense in this boundaried life. But the most precious love is what I call Eucharistic love. It's the capacity to have your heart broken without turning to bitterness. And I think it's the most exquisite name of God of love that exists. And in very, very deep mystical souls, we're brought back again and again and again to that. Yes, it frequently ends in martyrdom. And the structures that are built after martyrdom are just taken apart again. You know, it all gets plugged right in. So it's all in a deep sense useless. Except in those moments where something shines through, in those paschal moments, we sense in a way that couldn't be sensed any other way what a human being is really all about and what God is all about. And so they'll stay. You know, and most of us will have just minor brushes with it. But every once in a while, someone will walk up to the plate and incarnate for our own time and space in a very deep way, touch once again the hem of that mystery. And God help you and God bless you, if it should be you. But Roger yearned to go that deeply, and I believe myself that one of the holiest vocations of a human being is to be able to yearn more and more purely to share and touch that place, whatever it brings.
My question is for contemplatives, is there a social justice aspect to that life? I guess what I'm trying to ask is if we accept that the gospel is about challenging injustice and speaking truth to power, how does that fit into the contemplative life?
Oh, yes,
life?
That's a very good question, a wonderful question. And very often, contemplatives have been tarred with the brush of being the ones that just sit on their cushion and don't get involved. You know, and it's been looked at very often as, you know, bailing out of the world. And there was a time, frankly, in the 80s when those accusations could have come close to true. You know, hello, I'm doing my little meditation. But practically speaking, what goes on is this, that contemplation makes us truly capable of action in a way that reduces the burnout factor and that is in fact impels us to action, because the heart of compassion makes it impossible for us not to act. There's a very interesting thing, though, that a lot of people will go to the story of Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple to say, well, you know, that even Jesus got angry at the abuses and threw people out and had to work out of his righteous zeal and anger. But if you look at how this story is told in one of the Gospels, I think it's John, he came and checked it out and then came back the next day and gave it his karate chop. So he wasn't acting out of anger. He was acting out of what his heart saw as an absolutely necessary response to a social situation in order to restore integrity. I think that we need to learn to work that way. And that there's a beautiful line from an American spiritual director, now dead, Gerald May, who wrote, as attachment ceases to be your motivation, your actions will become reflections of compassion absolute. It's a very powerful and disturbing quote. As attachment ceases to be your motivation, your actions will become reflections of compassion absolute. And many of us enter spiritual or social justice witnessing active actions out of attachment. We're very attached to our ideals, our principles, our urgency, our sense of what needs to be done. And that kind of, see, we're back to this again, creates burnout and backlash. And that when you move into a cause by demonizing others, you empower them. You give them life. You get that old reptilian brain in them going. So the trick that the contemplative can bring is to learn how to stand inwardly surrendered, letting go, unattached, non-identified, outwardly moving by what is required by conscience and compassion. And hopefully in that combination, move into the world doing what is required, but doing it in ways that don't create these swirling back addies of enemies. You know, and I think in our own time, the Dalai Lama is a wonderful example of trying to move in this direction, of standing up for things that have to be stood up for and of giving voices. And part of the reason that I began the talk with you this evening the way I did is because I think that time is very much upon us and that we have to stand up, each one of us. And it's not a matter of saying, well, I haven't had my leader's training yet, so I can't run a group, or I don't know anything. That we are, each one of us, a coiled ball of spiritual experience, wisdom, and integrity in a planet that is requiring these things in doses that we've never seen before. We have to find ways to come forth and join hands and find our authority. But we have to do it like contemplatives, which is to move as closely as possible out of openness and compassion. And then the actions reflect a different reality. Excellent question. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Andrew. Thank you very much, Cynthia, for your time and your wisdom.